I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas.
There was a time when beaver lodges like this one and the busy beavers that build them had almost disappeared from Canada because of overtrapping.
But the beaver... I've probably, you know, seen beavers like many dozens times in my life, but I still get really excited when I see one. And I think they're definitely an iconic Canadian animal.
In 1975, Canada officially named the world's second largest rodent its national animal. It was easy to love the buck-toothed icon back then, perhaps because most Canadians had little or no contact with real beavers. 400 years of fur trade slaughter had nearly driven Castor canadensis to extinction. Today, beavers are alive and well. Too well, some might say.
Beavers in conflict. It's the story of my life. I think people either really love them or they really hate them.
We have a tendency to actually label the animal like the most evil thing. They are killing the trees. They are causing flood. Everything is the fault of the beaver, when in reality, it is totally the opposite.
Biologists suggest that we think of beavers as allies because of their ecological contributions. A tough proposition for some. After all, beavers rival humans in shaping landscapes and waterways, and they certainly don't give up easily. So beavers challenge our assumption that humans are nature's apex engineer. In this episode of Ideas, contributor Frances Backhouse reflects on the evolution of our relationship with beavers, from exploitation to needful coexistence. We call this show Rethinking the Beaver. And it's fitting that it begins in a rainstorm, because water and beavers are inseparable.
Why is it hard to live alongside beavers? Well, I like to say that you've got two control freaks that are trying to compete for the same resources.
This is Glynis Hood, a professor of environmental science at the University of Alberta's Augustana campus. She spent 20 years studying beavers.
One person got mad at me saying that beavers were control freaks. They were just doing what they're doing. But we both modify landscapes really dramatically. And I think that when people see nature, they want it to be in that postcard form sometimes. They want it to be stable and not change. Beavers are the ultimate in landscape changers. They will not leave the habitat in the same form in which they found it. They can't. They're always busy. They're always modifying things. And people like to do the same thing, but they want it to be on their own terms. And I think that they just haven't met somewhere in the middle.
Glynis lives on the edge of Miquelon Lake Provincial Park, about 45 minutes southeast of Edmonton. This is beaver country. In fact, the region is called the Beaver Hills. It's internationally recognized as a biosphere reserve because it links the prairies to the south with the boreal to the north. It's perfect territory for a beaver biologist. A small lake with three beaver lodges lies just beyond Glynis' back door. We'd begun our conversation in the woods near her house, keeping a wary eye and ear on the weather.
Right now you're hearing aspen trees, trembling aspen, and so that is the main kind of tree that we have here, although there's some birch, some balsam poplar, and some spruce mixed in.
Aspen is one of the beaver's favorite food trees, so it's not surprising they love this area.
Yeah, there have been a lot of beavers around here. Actually, the Cree name is Misquiche, which it means beaver hills. And there are so many beavers here that almost any site that is available has been occupied at least once in its history.
The North American beaver's original range extended from coast to coast and from just south of the Rio Grande to the northern tree line. Some experts suggest the continent had tens of millions of beavers before Europeans arrived. But abundance was no defense against the fur trade.
They can't tolerate really high levels of trapping over long periods of time. They're very, very dependent on their one pond location. Juveniles don't leave the adults until 2 years of age. They don't have more than one set of kits per year, and they have density-dependent reproduction as well, where they can hold off on having kits in a certain year if the resources aren't that plentiful. And, you know, I'm really cautious when I deal with population numbers, but there were a lot. And then there were very few, so there's my population estimates. And they were pretty much wiped out of most of North America, starting from the eastern seaboard. And so in North America, believe it or not, this animal was almost gone. And I'll meet people that are maybe in their 50s or 60s, and they'll be complaining about beavers, saying they were never here. This is a new thing. And I'll say, well, in your lifetime, they were never here. But for millennia, they were probably here in quite great abundance, but they're just making their comeback now in certain areas. And it has defied all odds, I would say, because it was a full-on industrial fur trade where beavers were the currency for North America.
Beavers are iconic, and so is hinterland who's who. Its famous music always takes me back to the basement of my family's home, where I would sit transfixed in front of our small black and white TV.
But the beaver, who will always be associated with Canada's early days...
This vignette first aired in 1963.
The beaver builds dams because he has to store his winter's food in water deep enough not to freeze.
The grainy film shows a couple of beavers gliding about in a placid pond and working on their dam.
For a more complete story of the beaver, why not contact the Canadian Wildlife Service in Ottawa?
To me, they're an academic interest because I'm a student of the fur trade. As an archaeologist, I've done historic archaeology at a fur trading post and in a community that lived on the fur trade. So for me, it's an intellectual exercise. I don't go out and trap beavers. I wouldn't know how to pan a beaver hide, you know. So hunting in the libraries or archives is the extent of my connection to beavers.
Right.
And of course, you know, they're on the nickel, so it's always my pocket change.
Yes.
Good day. My name is Eldon Yellowhorn. I have a Blackfoot name, which is Utkotskina, which means Yellowhorn. I am the Yellowhorn. And I'm from the Piikani First Nation, which is in the Northern Plains, Northern Montana, Southern Alberta. And I've been teaching here at SFU now for nigh on 20 years.
Eldon Yellowhorn and I are in his office at Simon Fraser University. We're talking about the fur trade, the Blackfoot, and of course, about beavers. Eldon's insights are shaped by his research in both anthropology and the emerging field of Indigenous archaeology.
So one of the things that it does give me is a real appreciation for how our ancestors became involved in the fur trade and the kind of industry that it required of them, and how their lives depended on it. You know, I always remember this phrase of Le castor fait tout, the beaver makes everything, because it could exchange it for like consumer goods and all that. So there was this real idea that, oh, the beaver is the benefactor, it gets you all these good things, you know.
When Europeans arrived in North America, hats made from felted beaver fur were all the rage back home. That fashion fad had nearly eradicated the Eurasian beaver, castor fever. Now here was another continent teeming with beavers. The newcomers started mining this brown gold as rapidly as they could, and they recruited Indigenous people to help them. But some First Nations declined to participate, despite the pressure and incentives.
The culture I'm from, which is Blackfoot, Piikani, beaver were never really a commodity. For one thing, there was an emphasis on buffalo hunting. That was a buffalo hunting culture. So they didn't really go for foods out of the water. Blackfoot wouldn't eat fish, for example. In the fur trade era, that was one of the reasons why Blackfoot people were always very reticent about getting into the fur trade in a big way that way. Because beaver had such a strong mythological and religious part of Blackfoot culture that it would really be attacking your own religion to then going out willy-nilly and just killing all the beavers that you saw, you know. But there were lots of other fur-bearing animals out on the land that they could harvest.
So what made beavers different?
The Blackfoot name for beavers, Kshishtaki, it's an allusion to the placing wood in a pattern across the water. And so their name is basically their occupation, you know. And in Blackfoot mythology, you know, we go right back to the beginning of time and the Blackfoot understanding of the universe, that the world was created and destroyed several times we know of.
Like many stories that explain the origins of the universe, the Blackfoot account is long and complicated and involves humans failing to take care of the nice things they've been given, like the world. When the humans in this story fall short of expectations, the Star People destroy the world with a flood. One star man, called Napi, tries unsuccessfully to avert the disaster. Eventually, he ends up adrift on a raft with the few animals that have survived the flood, the loon, the muskrat, the otter, and the beaver. And he hatches a plan to create a new world.
So he tells his animal friends, all I need is a sample from the old world and I can recreate it. And so each of these animals dives down and the loon goes first and then the muskrat goes next and then the otter tries. And then finally the beaver is the one that makes it to the bottom, but he ultimately has to sacrifice his life. So when he, you know, his lifeless body floats back to the surface and they pull him aboard their raft and they find the mud in his paw. And that's what Napi works with, and he's able to recreate the world, but also to reward Beaver. He brings him back to life, restores his life, and makes him chief of the water people, you know, so he can control water and make habitat for the otter and the loon and the muskrat, you know. So all these other water people benefit from his talents.
That creation story isn't the beaver's only appearance in Blackfoot mythology.
In Blackfoot tradition, the gift of tobacco came from the chief of the beavers. And in this story, you know, there's a couple of brothers who are in love with the same woman. You know, one brother realizes...
It's a classic tale of fraternal rivalry. It's also a narrative that explains the origin of two things that are central to Blackfoot culture, tobacco and the beaver medicine bundle.
And the beaver medicine bundle is like the most sacred of these medicine bundles in Blackfoot religion. And so when this fellow leaves the chief of the beaver's lodge, he's got tobacco seeds and knowledge of this beaver medicine bundle and how to make it, the songs and rituals that are performed with it.
Every beaver medicine bundle is unique, but they all contain beaver elements, like teeth or fur, that link them back to the story of the gifts.
But as an anthropologist, I'm looking at it in terms of, like, what is the significance of the beaver? And it turns out that the beaver and beaver habitat is the kind of environmental cues that they were looking for in order to where to situate your tobacco garden. Because Blackfoot people were a mobile culture. Farming or cultivating plants requires that you stay in one place. So here is a plant that has to fend for itself while they go off and do their buffalo hunting and their berry gathering and all other things. And then when they come back in the fall, they fully expect that there's going to be a crop there. First of all, if you situate your tobacco garden near where there's a beaver dam, there's going to be a high water table all the time. The roots will naturally get the soil moisture from there.
Indigenous societies understood that the beaver's drive to control water benefits other animals and plants, but science was slow to catch up. That was because biology's rise as a scientific discipline coincided with the beaver's decline. In the early 1900s, beaver advocates finally convinced governments to restrict trapping and start reintroducing beavers. As the beaver population recovered, research intensified. And in 1986, biologists declared Castor canadensis a keystone species.
If you think about an arch and there's that one stone that holds the whole arch together, and if that stone's removed, everything collapses around it. Well, often when you remove beavers from a landscape or a keystone species from a landscape, what happens is that the system it supports starts to shut down as well.
Glynis Hood.
Species start to blink off, and landscapes become way less vibrant, way less biodiverse. And when beavers come back, you start to see this lifeblood start to come back into the landscape. You start to see amphibians coming back. You start to see riparian songbirds. You start to see waterfowl. The aquatic invertebrate communities become more biodiverse. The plant communities are really interesting to examine. The water chemistry changes.
Even the ice dynamics change.
Once I was sitting on top of a beaver lodge. Yeah, I know I'm a bit odd that way, but I was sitting on top of a beaver lodge and it was bee day. And for me, that's the most exciting day of the year because that's when the beavers first come out of their lodges and there's a little pocket of water in front of the lodge. They might have chewed through the ice to open it up, or it just opened up normally because the ice is quite thin in front of the lodges. And there was this beaver that just swims up to the edge of the ice and it just starts voraciously chewing at it, going under the water, chewing at it from underneath, going back on, and actively increasing the size of this open water in front of their lodge so that the pond will open up sooner, and increasing the size of the water body ultimately for other species. So ravens will come in and drink out of this as well, and all of these animals, you do winter tracking and you see all these tracks going up to the edge.
Beavers aren't intentional altruists. When they alter the environment, it's for their own purposes. But study after study confirms their keystone credentials.
They're also known as an ecosystem engineer. And beavers will build lodges, they'll build dams, they'll build channels, they'll reshape pond bottoms, they'll completely change landscapes. They also will cut down trees on the edge of their ponds and change riparian forests, those forests that are adjacent to water bodies. And then when beavers leave, the forest will regenerate. And after time, beavers often come back and the whole cycle starts again.
If beavers had resumes, they might also highlight their experience as water stewards. Their ponds capture rainfall and snowmelt and divert it into the groundwater system. The water is stored and released gradually instead of rushing downstream and causing erosion. Beaver ponds also increase surface water storage.
So even during extreme drought, we find that ponds with active beaver colonies in them have quite a bit more water than ponds that have been abandoned by beaver. And in the drought of 2002, which was the worst drought on record, we found that ponds with beaver had 9 times more open water extent than ponds without beaver, and sometimes they were the only ponds that actually had water in them still. I think the coolest thing with beavers is that no matter how much I study these species from every angle that you can think of, there's always something else that leads to another research question, because they are really complex. It's not just that they build a dam, it's how they build the dam, how they understand where to build that dam. It's not just that they can change landscapes, it's how the landscape responds to that change, not just in that one instance in time, but over time as well.
Honorable senators, picture it, 19th century Europe. The streets of every major European capital are bustling with fashionistas. And what are they wearing? Fur hats were the fashion statement of the day.
On October 27th, 2011, Senator Nicole Eaton rose in the Red Chamber to talk about beavers.
In Canada. By the mid-1900s, the Canadian beaver was close to extinction. Since then, the rodent has slowly recovered. And today, the population is well into the millions. Not everyone is happy. Many accuse the dentally defective rat of being a nuisance.
Dentally defective rat?
Roads, lakes, streams, and tree plantations, including my dock every summer. Nevertheless, the Toothy Tyrant received the highest honor ever bestowed.
Toothy Tyrant?
On March 24, 1975, the beaver became an official emblem of Canada. While I would never speak ill of our furry friend, I stand here today suggesting that perhaps it is time for a change. Yes, honorable senators.
After Senator Eaton's speech, many outraged Canadians rallied to the beaver's defense. But a significant minority agreed with her.
Beavers in conflict. It is the story of my life. I think people either really love them or they really hate them. And that I get my phone ringing off the hook from both sides of it. Every week I get two or three emails, even through the winter, about beaver conflict. Either somebody wants to stop people from removing beavers, or somebody wants to learn how to get rid of beavers or how to deal with two major things. The biggest one is flooding, especially in the spring. The second one is the cutting of trees.
The problem isn't so much the number of beavers around today. It's that we humans have appropriated much of the territory they used to occupy.
We've lost in Alberta alone almost 70% of our non-boreal wetlands. We've diverted streams throughout Canada. We have built large urban centers and have agricultural land where it could have been beaver habitat. So what I usually tell people is that where there's available habitat, beavers have likely reoccupied. And they're not an endangered species anymore.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas on CBC Radio, on cbc.ca, and on the CBC Radio app, as well as on podcast and Sirius XM. On this episode, we're rethinking the beaver. The gunshot crack of a beaver tail slapping water is an iconic and unforgettable Canadian sound. But for many decades, we almost forgot about the beaver itself. It was easy to do. Centuries of intensive trapping for their valuable fur almost wiped them off the map. Now, with a little help from humans, they're making a comeback. In this documentary, Francis Backhouse is exploring what it means to share territory with an animal whose ability to shape landscapes rivals our own.
So, is the pond half full of beavers, or is it half empty? That's the question that launched Mike Callahan's career as a beaver management specialist in Massachusetts. It all started with a state vote on the trapping of beavers.
The voter referendum in Massachusetts, which restricted trapping, was back in 1996, and beavers became very politicized. And so my wife and I started a volunteer group to find options to help people but keep beavers around, and I decided to start it as a part-time business in 2000.
Mike's business is called Beaver Solutions. He's also the founding president of the Beaver Institute. It's a nonprofit that promotes non-lethal approaches to resolving human-beaver conflicts. Like any good mediator, he begins by considering what each side wants.
They're a lot like us people, humans, where they will modify the environment to suit their own needs. And so sometimes the dams that they build will flood out human property or roads or septic systems, you name it. And then a conflict exists. And so traditionally, the way to manage it was kill the beavers and tear out the dam.
But what happens is beaver are there because it is really good habitat, or there is no better habitat to which they can disperse. And so
this is Glynis Hood of the University of Alberta.
They end up coming back. And I've seen dams removed and gone back the next morning and the dam is twice as high as it was the day before. I've seen colonies removed and within 6 weeks to 3 months there's a brand new colony in there. And not only that, they're usually young dispersers who want to make it their own and add their own flair onto how they want to change things. So sometimes they're a little bit more aggressive in how they want to build things and how quick they're doing it.
there are better ways to manage it where we can protect human interests but keep the beavers around. And that, so that's what we do with Beaver Solutions. And so my clients can be anyone. It could be a homeowner, it could be a town, it could be the state. And about 60% of what I do is working for highway departments. You know, you have a road bed and it has a culvert pipe going underneath it. To a beaver, that looks like a dam with a hole in it. So they just want to fix that. And they're smart that way, where for a little bit of work, the whole roadbed becomes a dam.
Mike has learned that the best way to control beavers is to trick them into thinking that they're in control.
If you design a pipe that the beavers don't detect the flow of water into, then they won't plug it up. But if they can detect the flow of water either by sound or by the feel of the moving water, they will do what they have evolved to do, is plug that leak. So these pond leveler pipes, we call them, they're usually about 40 feet long and they go out into the pond. They need about a meter or 3 feet of depth of water to submerge the intake into. And then that end is protected with fencing. So the beavers, when they swim by, they can't get close enough to plug the pipe, nor do they get close enough to be able to feel or hear water going into the pipe. Instead, they'll hear water coming out of the outflow end of the pipe, which is in the dam itself, and they'll add mud to the dam thinking there's a leak, but it doesn't do any good. The pipe creates a permanent leak through there. And there aren't moving parts. It's piping and fencing. And because the concepts are and the designs are relatively straightforward and simple, there's less things that can go wrong. And I've installed over 1,400 of them. So with these devices, we have success rates anywhere, depending on the design, 96 to 99% successful. And this is over many years.
Glynis Hood has also started installing flow devices.
And I've put in about 30 of these now. I've turned into a wetland plumber and have had some really great success. And we've had some of the pond levelers without any to very little maintenance for over 7 years. There's some catastrophic failures that kept me awake all night. Beavers are very clever, and every site is different. You have to always think like a chess player, and you think, okay, if I do this in this spot, what's the beaver's counter move? And if it does that counter move, how can I use that counter move in order to respond to make sure I put this pond leveler in right the first time? Because taking them out is a nightmare.
In 2007, a beaver showed up in the Bronx River. It took everyone by surprise. New York City was founded on the beaver pelt fur trade, but this was the first wild beaver seen there in 200 years. Canadian cities also have growing populations of beavers. One pair has settled amongst the million-dollar condos in Vancouver's Olympic Village. Others have been spotted scouting out the trendy Queens Quay district in Toronto, cruising the streets in downtown Ottawa, and trying to get into a pub in Waterloo. Urban beavers are often welcomed as novelties at first, but their engineering plans don't always go down well at City Hall.
I was out walking the dog, and I'm standing there looking at this beaver, and I'm thinking, gee, I never noticed that before. And then the next thing I notice is this beaver.
Jim Atkinson and Judy Taylor Atkinson live in Port Moody, part of Metro Vancouver. They're residents of a high-density condominium and townhouse development with a creek running through it. As longtime members of the Association for the Protection of Fur-Bearing Animals, they'd helped solve beaver conflict situations in other municipalities. Then beavers arrived on their doorstep.
And I thought, oh my gosh, we've got beavers. And I knew that there wasn't going to be a welcome mat laid out for them and it was going to be a rocky reception. But I thought, okay, they've moved into our creek. They couldn't have better advocates than Jim and I living close by, and we just waded right into the whole thing.
That was in October of 2016. A year and a half later, Judy and Jim are showing me where the beavers originally settled.
Okay, right now we're standing on the little pedestrian bridge that crosses over Pigeon Creek, and we're looking over the dam toward the culvert, which is where the beavers first set up their home. And there's a lot of willow There's dogwood. Oh, yeah, lots of cedar. There's a lot of cottonwood. And on either side of the creek, there are two low-rise buildings, four-story low-rise buildings of condominiums. And plus, I'm looking at the Evergreen Line, the SkyTrain that goes from Port Moody all the way down to Vancouver. So, yes, it's a very urban environment. And yet the beaver chose to move in here and fit in quite nicely. And then as they got more comfortable around people, they started coming out more later in the morning, a little earlier in the evening. And so the community really started to respond in a very positive way because we were watching them work. And
at first, Port Moody city officials wanted to get rid of the beavers.
What happened was that we kept advocating very strongly for the right of these beavers to stay here because we were controlling the damage. The trees were being properly wrapped. The public was really engaged. There was not going to be a danger of flooding from the dam because a flow device could easily be put into this dam. It's very accessible and wouldn't have been a problem. So then through the summer, especially when the two kits showed up in late June, they were born a little bit late, and then the public really, literally fell in love with this family. And there were some great videos that were posted to YouTube, and people were showing up from other municipalities. Every evening, there were sometimes people were three deep trying to catch glimpses of them, and you'd meet people and you'd talk to people and you met your neighbors, and it was such an unusual circumstance that brought the whole community together.
Meanwhile, the beavers were also transforming the non-human community.
That transition of our stream to a pond, we watched that for a full year. All of a sudden, there were birds, there were waterfowl that showed up.
We had our first duck family. We ended up with nine ducklings in here, and all the different amphibians there. We had four different types of salamanders. And we had a lot of things going on here that a lot of people didn't realize. And it was amazing, like, what has the beaver brought to Port Moody?
But then they moved into the culvert that runs under Klahani Drive.
Finally, just due to an really unfortunate circumstance in December when the city was excluding the beaver from the culvert, one of the kits drowned. There was a lot of anger, a great deal of sadness, almost a period of mourning when we all realized that we'd lost one of these kits that we'd been watching for months. The kit was about six or seven months old at that time, still very dependent on their parents, and we'd been watching them play with the parents and a lot of vocalizations, which is really, when you hear a beaver kit vocalize, I'll tell you, it really tugs at your heartstrings because it's a very soft mewing sound. And so then that anger and that resolve got turned on to the city, and the city realized and they apologized for it. And then out of that was born the idea that we could come up with a plan for the beavers that would allow us to coexist. Hopefully this plan will not only identify the risks that the beavers can potentially pose on a community, but also identify the risks to other animals and the ecosystems if you don't have beavers here.
There's something going on.
The other area that we check, that's the step dam just there in the distance. And they've been...
My first visit with Judy and Jim was in the spring of 2018. By then, the three surviving members of the beaver family had moved to Suterbrook Creek.
Yeah, I think he's right.
3 months later, I'm back to see how they fared over the summer.
We're still in very much in an urban environment. We're just standing next to the public works yard, and on the other side of the creek are some tennis courts. It's definitely quieter and a little more seclusion for the beavers and a little more privacy. There's lots of good food for them.
But there's one catch. A small number of migratory salmon spawn in Suterbrook Creek, which brings the Department of Fisheries and Oceans into the mix. Beavers probably lived here in the past, along with salmon and other fish. But some fisheries managers take a dim view of the dam builder's return.
The DFO kind of considers beaver dams just to be an impediment to salmon migration for both the fry and the spawners in the fall, which is unfortunate, because I think the main body of research now is showing that in fact beaver dams are a particular benefit to any native fish populations. The pools provide good nursery habitat for salmon.
As the fall spawning season approaches, Judy and Jim worry that the DFO will exercise its right to breach the Sudabrook dams. They know they have more work ahead, advocating and educating and negotiating. But they're still grateful that the beavers stayed in their community.
The yearling seems to be getting a little more independent, so he's not like a Velcro beaver anymore with the adult. You know, he seems to be kind of doing his own, or her own thing, a little more independent.
You can see the ripples on the top of the creek there. So he's either over there eating something. This looks like the yearling.
Hanging in the water.
Just laying in the water there. No, I think it is the adult, because look at the width of the head. Yeah.
Down he goes.
Yeah, down he goes.
See the trail of bubbles.
Yeah. He's heading up the creek. This was the adult. Yeah, for sure. When it curled into the water, you could just see how much beaver there was. It was big. Yeah.
We are pretty close here to the Elbow River, so quite often they'll make a lot of their home kind of in these tributaries. I've probably, you know, seen beavers like many dozens times in my life, but I still get really excited when I see one.
Holly Kinnis is a research assistant at the Mistakis Institute. It's an Alberta-based environmental research center. One of the projects she works on is called Putting Beavers to Work for Watershed Resiliency and Restoration. I'm with Holly in Calgary's Griffith Woods Park.
In this park in particular, there is a giant beaver here who's like 60 to 75 pounds, I would say. And he's a happy, healthy, big boy. And when you see him, you know, waddle out of the water, I'm always shocked at how large they are.
Unlike in Port Moody, beavers returned to Calgary decades ago. Over time, the city has come to accept that they're here to stay. Trapping and killing the troublemakers is now their last resort.
So I spoke with the Calgary Parks Department yesterday, and they were saying that they haven't been able to estimate the Calgary beaver population, but if they were to guess, it would be in the hundreds for sure, which is quite surprising when you look at the size of Calgary, how urban Calgary actually is, how restricted some of our river valleys can be. But you have parks like this with tributaries, with smaller creeks, and it creates ideal beaver habitat. So the city of Calgary tries to coexist with beavers when they can.
Here on the western edge of the city, the park staff found themselves at odds with one highly motivated beaver, that happy, healthy big boy that Holly mentioned. So 2 years ago, the Putting Beavers to Work project stepped in to help the city play a more effective chess game. The first move was to install a pond leveler and wrap wire mesh around the trunks of some nearby trees.
And you can see the tree wiring here. This is a very industrious beaver, and they had to go with the half-inch spacing. Mm-hmm. Usually they can get away with 2-inch or 1-inch spacing, but this particular beaver was quite crafty. So they kind of had to adjust their plan and work around that when they wired these trees here. So what the city of Calgary has been doing is they have it down to an art now, wiring trees. They literally wire thousands and thousands of trees every year, all along all the rivers and waterways in the city of Calgary. Their main goal is to coexist with beavers where they can. So they don't want to fence out every tree, because then, of course, the beavers won't have any food. So we're a little bit downstream of where our pond leveler was, and quite often this pathway would be flooded because the beaver, of course, hearing the running water and wanting to dam to create their beaver pond, would plug this culvert up. So there was a big need to have an exclusion device put in here. And Calgary Parks was telling me that this particular site, they would be clearing this culvert 2 to 3 times per week. So since they've just installed this device in the fall of 2016, they haven't had to come back and do any maintenance on it.
Early in the last century, the beaver's greatest champion was Archibald Bellany, better known as Grey Owl. He wrote, "Beavers stood for something vital, something essential in this wilderness. They were the wilderness." Apparently, becoming citified hasn't diminished the species' power as a symbol.
I think they're definitely an iconic Canadian animal. I know that I still get excited when I see beavers. I just saw one a few weeks ago, and a typical urban beaver. It was surfing on a piece of garbage, which was surprising. It was in one of our parks that bordered along the Bow River, and it was standing on this piece of plastic, which was kind of wedged underneath a dead fall tree that was hanging over the water. So he was standing on this surfboard, reaching up to the tree and nibbling at the tree. And then, of course, when I came along, he jumps down and slaps his tail at me in anger because, you know, he doesn't want company. And yeah, so I don't know. They're always surprising to me. They're always doing something entertaining.
All right.
So you've got your chainsaw?
Yes. It's a Husqvarna.
Ah. Pierre Bolduc is about to fell an aspen tree on his property in the Alberta foothills. The aspens for Pierre's beavers, the ones he invited to live next door.
Voila, it's done.
Faster for you than the beaver.
Yes. So let me bag this up, mm-hmm. And we're going to chain it up. And
but before we drag the tree off to the beaver pond, I'll back up to earlier in the afternoon when I met Pierre and he started to tell me his story.
My name is Pierre Bolduc, and I was born in Quebec, and I used to be a trapper, taught by my dad. And when I went to high school, this is what I did to earn some money. Mm-hmm. And later on, well, I became a big game hunter. And I joined the military. And I stayed in the military for almost 35 years as a Hercules pilot.
12 years ago, Pierre and his family moved to an acreage near Bragg Creek, about 50 kilometers southwest of Calgary. I'm standing with Pierre on his back deck, looking out over the broad valley that runs through his land. A stream meanders between the rolling hills and widens out into a series of ponds just below the house. Those ponds weren't there when Pierre moved in, but he could see remnants of an old beaver lodge.
What did it look like here before the beaver ponds?
Very dry. There was a small trickle in spring, and then I had my two sons and I, and we decided to actually hold back the water.
Their goal was to create a place to play hockey in winter.
And what came out is we're able to elevate the thing by 6 inch to 1 foot of water after putting a lot of dirt and rocks and that sort of thing. And then when the rain came, it washed everything away. And that's when I decided that I really needed to have expertise engineers for them to come and build the dam. If you bring the beaver and you give the beaver some opportunity, they can actually do absolutely wonder.
Using beavers to make a hockey rink? Can't get much more Canadian than that. But before Pierre could put his plan into action, he had to canvass the community to garner support. He also needed the municipal district's blessing, because part of the creek runs through a small environmental reserve next to his property. Then a trapper rounded up his work crew, a family of beavers that had worn out its welcome elsewhere. To prepare for their arrival, Pierre piled up earth with his backhoe to create a temporary dam and pond. He cut brush from the roadside and stocked the job site with these building materials. But the ace up his sleeve was a CD he made of the sound of running water. It was a brainwave based on the beaver's obsession with plugging leaks.
So we used a CD player that had a repeat function from an old car with a battery and a solar panel and a bunch of speakers. So at that point, you line up exactly where you want your dam to go, and the beavers will get to work. It works fantastic.
Now, 8 years later, the beavers have created three ponds. The middle one is even big enough for a game of shinny, as long as the skaters avoid the massive lodge in the middle.
And now there is the third pond, which is almost in the back of the house. I put a measuring stick last year, and we're going to go and check out what is the level that it has gone up. I would guesstimate about a couple feet. This ended up to translate itself to 3 to 4 feet in the well water, which is absolutely fantastic. We used to be running out of water during dry time.
You're up here?
Yeah, for you not to fall off.
Good, okay, I don't want to fall off.
Oh, good.
Pierre has lots to show me this afternoon, so we jump on his ATV.
We're going to go and take a quick look.
Pierre credits the beavers with a multitude of improvements since they returned here. More water in residents' wells, the creation of a natural fire break, more moose, more birds, more frogs. Things did get a bit tense when the beavers began flooding a neighbor's access road, but the installation of a beaver-proof culvert fixed that problem.
But one of the reasons why they love this place is because they're not being stressed too much, and this is an environmental reserve, number one. Number two, I feed the beavers. In the big picture, feeding the beavers sounds like, oh my gosh, it is a 365 days job per year. Well, you could not be any further wrong. There is two periods of time that are absolutely critical to the beavers. And that's the only time that you need to feed them. Time number one is in the fall. So upon the first frost, all the beavers going, that's it. We need food storage for the winter. And my gosh, you can take those guys per lodge, I would say close to 10 trees. And then the other time period that you need to actually feed the beavers is as soon as the ice melts. After a long winter, those critters, they're starving and they're looking for food. Beside this, in the summer, in the winter, you don't need to.
As self-appointed head waiter to the beavers, Pierre can limit their impact on the trees closest to the pond.
For the beaver, the beautiful part about it is, look, somebody's going to serve me a meal, and it's right here in the water, and I love that. And so I don't need to get out and run the risk to be eaten by a wolf, cougar, or a bear. They much prefer to have a tree served right there on the beach, which we're going to do.
A few minutes later, we pull up by the pond.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
Gosh.
That's a big tree.
It's a big tree. Yeah. Perfect. Good.
There they go.
Should we go and sit on the chair?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Okay.
The chair is really a bench, carved from a large log, and it's perfect for surveying the beaver's domain.
It's so peaceful.
It is.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Now, what came out, I built a chair here from a tree, and I end up to actually put it there because most of the time when I come and feed the beaver here, this is the best place to have the site. And so what happened, people started to come, and I would say most evening, there's always a couple that's going to end up to be sitting here and enjoying the sight of the beaver. You know, what I want to do is to to get people to appreciate how lucky we are here in Canada to have this absolutely fantastic animal.
Sitting by Pierre's peaceful pond, it's easy to appreciate our national animal. But not all encounters with beavers are so idyllic. Sometimes their ideas about how to use territory and resources clash with ours. And sometimes working things out takes effort and a willingness to compromise. Still, there's mounting evidence that coexistence is cheaper and easier than doing battle with these tenacious mammals, and that we have much to gain from having them around. Back in the Beaver Hills, biologist Glynis Hood has some thoughts on that. First, though, I have a special request for her.
When we went out and walked around this area last time I was here, you actually called one of the beavers. At one point, we stopped by the pond and you called it. Will you do your beaver call?
You want me to do a beaver call again? With the thunder in the background, the beaver gods will start pouring down on us. You could try this as well, Francis. You have to close your mouth and you just do it through your nose. So it's... Try it. That'll do. That's a very shy beaver. See, it's starting to rain now, so if we want to move inside, we can.
If any beavers have heard our calls, we're not sticking around to observe their response. We make it to the house just as the skies open. Then, from the comfort of Glynis's dining room, we watch the rain bucket down while we talk about how to get along with our fellow control freaks and what's in it for us to keep trying.
What's in it for us? If we have healthy landscapes, if we have landscapes that have more water on them than not, if we have areas of high biodiversity that helps increase our own ecosystem health and the ecosystems on which we depend, I think that there's nothing but benefit there. I also think that emotionally and spiritually it is healthy for us to get back to understanding nature on its playing field as well. I think that we have become so disengaged and disconnected from nature that we really don't know ourselves anymore. We are part of nature, we came from nature, and we have just completely made a technological fence around ourselves. And that our mental health, our spiritual health, and our physical health all benefits from a healthy ecosystem. And I think that beavers will help bring those ecosystems back to life and give us a little bit of what I think we're missing right now.
Rethinking the Beaver by Francis Backhouse. It was produced in Victoria by Dave Riddell. Excerpts from Senator Eaton's speech were read by Lydia Neufeld. Francis Backhouse is the author of Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver. It's published by ECW Press. To learn more about beavers and about other Ideas episodes, go to our website, cbc.ca/ideas. While there, you can subscribe to our podcasts and to our weekly online newsletter. We're also available on Facebook and on Twitter. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy.